Hi, everybody, and welcome to the show. Mark Termini is a Cleveland-based sports attorney and agent. His MTA, that's Mark Termini Associates Company, was started back in 1986. The late Flip Saunders, a close friend of Mark's, pushed him to say, hey, why don't you hang up your shingle and go at it, see what you can do with a sports agency for athletes. And that's what he did. He has been called one of the finest contract attorneys in the country. From 2014 to 2019, Mark negotiated $1.4 billion in contracts, including the likes of LeBron James, Ben Simmons, Draymond Green, John Wall, Tristan Thompson, J.R. Smith, and more for Clutch Sports. The James 1+1 deal back in 2014 was unique and groundbreaking. But you know something? Termini's been behind unique and groundbreaking events throughout much of his career. He's never been even the kind of a guy that would seek the headline. Nobody named Tom Cruise is going to play Mark Termini in a movie. He just doesn't really do interviews that much, and that's why it was such a treat to sit down and chat with Mark. I've known him a long, long time. And he is an author. Words to Negotiate By is Termini's first book. I think it will be the first of many. It's a collection of around 300 sayings with Termini's input as to how each one applies to business and negotiations, especially sports negotiations. The book, by the way, is available on Amazon and wherever you get your books. Fascinating read. I enjoyed it very, very much. Let's get back into his career. In 1992, he shook up the sports world, especially the NBA, by holding his client, the number 4 pick in the draft, Jim Jackson of Ohio State. He didn't let him sign. He didn't sign in the summer. He didn't sign in the fall.
Because I didn't speak during the negotiations at all, but around the country, people were saying, you know, they put the banner up. It's a players' league now. Termini can go to any player and say, come with me, hold out, we'll get what we want. I didn't approach it that way, but that was, you know, it was like you either win or you're dead.
Jackson got his money, 6 years, $20 million. He only played 28 games that season, but that did shift the paradigm between the owners and the players. And much more was to follow after that groundbreaking scenario, negotiating tactics employed by Mark Termini. So what's to follow? Well, Termini's going to talk about LeBron James, Ted Stepien, Jim Jackson, as I mentioned, the Ron Harper deal, and he talks a lot about his negotiating style. Here he is, sports attorney and agent. Words to Negotiate By, Mark Termini. I am really blessed that this guy, Mark Termini, has agreed to sit down and chat about not just the book, Words to Negotiate By, but your career and a longtime NBA, for the most part, agent and a guy that's represented some and has had some groundbreaking work in the league, the National Basketball Association. Mark, let's go back. You're a great athlete at Holy Name High School, Case Western Reserve. Your father was a coach. You had that upbringing in suburban Cleveland. What were some of the factors that kind of got you down the road to the point where you became a lawyer and then eventually got to the point where you wanted to represent athletes?
Well, good morning, John. Thanks for the invitation to this.
My pleasure.
You know, podcast that's very popular and very honored to be part of. What got me down the road as far as being a sports agent is that I didn't want to be a real lawyer, you know, so I didn't know much about anything except basketball.
Okay.
And the personality that I have, and even at the early stages that I developed, is I wanted to have my own shop, my own agency. I wanted to be independent. I had a bit of a, and still have an entrepreneurial streak. And that's what was intriguing to me about representing athletes. There was no master plan, but literally when I came out of college at Case Reserve, I was, at the time, my misguided motivation was to be the best basketball player I could be at CWRU. I was fortunate to have a legendary coach by the name of Bill Sudeck that said, hey, a player of your dimensions, size-wise, those were the days when basketball, they thought the more diminutive player was going to be a dinosaur, was going to be eliminated from the game when the shooting guard was 6'9" and the point guard was 6'8". So there was that trend, but Coach Sudeck said, hey, if you work hard at the game and you're the best player, and if you, you know, want to shoot a few of the balls, you're welcome to do so. A lot of the other colleges around didn't give that leeway.
Okay.
And so I went to Case Reserve for that as the motivation. It was the fantastic school. I would never trade that in for any other educational experience, but I also got to learn and meet a lot of different kind of people. It wasn't a homogenized situation. Coming from Holy Name, also a great situation, but you know, you're in a parochial school, you don't get the diversity and the interaction, which at the time I didn't realize. So it was a great education, and the good part about being a Division III player, unless you're totally delusional, when you come out, you know that the real world awaits. You're not going to Europe. You're not going to the NBA. So it was very clear, as much as I put in the basketball, that was my goal all the time. And after that, I had some sales jobs at the Holiday Inn downtown. Great experiences that I wouldn't trade for the world, but obviously not what I wanted to do. Then I went up and was Flip Saunders' assistant in Minneapolis, Minnesota at a small junior college. He's 23, I'm 22. He was my friend from high school and college, a year, the college years.
Yeah, he was Cuyahoga Heights guy.
Cuyahoga Heights, one of the greatest all-time players, really, in state of Ohio history, right from Brooklyn Heights, Cuyahoga Heights school system. And we became friends. He went to the University of Minnesota. I went to Case Reserve. He played with Kevin McHale and Michael Thompson, those kind of iconic NBA players. And I did my Division III thing, but we would commiserate and play and hang out during the summers. So he goes on to be a coach. He said, why don't you come up here to be my assistant coach? I'm like, hey, I'm tired of selling rooms at the Holiday Inn at 22nd Street, director of sales, which I became in a year, by the way, because everybody just probably stayed a year and then they moved on. So I didn't know what I was doing. It was a great experience, knocking on doors around downtown Cleveland, say, hey, you want to have your convention or bring your company,
bring it to my place,
Holiday
baby.
Inn at 22nd. So I go up to Flip. I'm his assistant coach. I thought maybe I'd want to be an assistant coach or something in sports, public relations. I really had, as a lot of young people do at the time, not a lot of definition or master plan. Right around that time, Mr. Ted Stepien comes from Pittsburgh to Nationwide Advertising, buys the Cavs, and actually had followed me at Case Western Reserve, was had an acquaintance with my dad, and was looking for a ticket salesman. And I said, I can do that. And I came back to Cleveland to be a season ticket salesman for the Cavs. Without getting into the history of the Cavs and Ted Stepien, which is another podcast.
It really
on
is.
On its own. People don't realize, and the ties till today, you were there.
I was there.
We both lived it.
Yes.
I learned a great book of information and history, unbelievable education, but the ship started to take on water.
It did.
Right? And I was at least astute enough to see that at the time. And I said, now what am I going to do, basically? Because I'm probably not going to be general manager of the Cavs, because Mr. Stepien's probably going to exit the scene. Yep. And I had seen how political those jobs were. If a new owner brought in his nephew and said, hey, you're going to be the GM, then the current GM was probably going to be out, no matter how astute he was. It was just a real eye-opener. So then I refocused and was fortunate enough to have some family that supported me, and I could, you know, scurry back home and live with mom and dad, and started law school at Cleveland Marshall. And then I became very serious about the academics, because now it was kind of reality time. So either I got through this and became a lawyer, which was incredible in my mind in itself. Like in college or high school, if you would have said, you know, would you ever think of becoming an attorney? I would have said, well, I would no more think I'd become an attorney than I would become an astronaut.
Yeah.
That's how far-fetched it was for somebody from Garfield Heights, from a family that were teachers and coaches. There was no aspiration or path to being something that was so unattainable or out of our thought process. So I approached that with ultimate seriousness. I was older, now I was 3 years out of college, and I just put the nose to the grindstone, and fortuitously, pro sports started to take off at that time. That was really the era that started in the late 70s, going into early 80s, where you started seeing the salaries escalate from the early years in all sports. Yeah. And I didn't have a master plan of being a sports attorney or agent, but a couple of young men that had worked with me and for me when I ran basketball camps around town ended up becoming pro prospects. Scott Roth was the first, Brad Sellers from Warrensville was the second, and in those days, they just showed and looked at me as somebody they trusted. I was a lawyer. Little did they know how little just being a lawyer applied to their representation. It really takes much, much more.
Yeah.
But they made a decision based on the trust factor, fortunately for me. And then my challenge was to do a good job for them to try to build a business. And that's how it all transpired. That's kind of a medium story, not a short one. But
no, the fascinating part to me is the fact that, you know, you went to a great school, you got your education the way that you did, but then there were some other sidetracked parts of your ascension into the job that you started for yourself, the agency you started for yourself, and there were factors that kind of came into play to lean you into that direction, like Flip. I mean,
for sure.
Flip Saunders, here's a guy, and maybe if we can dovetail into one of the quotes in your book, Words to Negotiate By, written by Mark Termini. And the first quote I want to tell our listeners about is, quote, "If you wait, all that happens is that you get older." That's Mario Andretti said it, but it maybe comes into play with the Flip Saunders story about you starting your own agency.
Well, it's right on point. That's the comment that I attached to that saying, because there was a time when, even though I was an attorney, at the time I was representing probably Scott Roth was the first, but then the next year is Ron Harper and Brad Sellers as lottery picks in the 1986 draft. It was right around that time. And then because of being able to do a good job for Ron and Brad, I was getting a little traction with picking up other clients, still a very small group, and being in a formative stage as to, I mean, literally, my wife Wendy, who was finishing law school then, we were working out of our apartment in Bedford Green, right? And Ron would come over, and it was not a, let's say, professional setup at the time. We got the job done, and fortunately, it didn't require a fancy office. The guys trusted us, and it was about getting the contract. As long as I got the contract, whether I was negotiated a contract that they were satisfied with and could stand up to the scrutiny and the competition around the league, it was okay whether I was at a kitchen table or at a fancy law firm downtown. But those were the early stages. So I had to make a commitment. Am I going to make the investment, jump in full speed? I never would practice law, but of course there were people coming with marginal cases. Can you handle this? Can you handle that? We did a little bit of that, but it became clear with this level player, I had to make a commitment and go all in, as they say, which is very risky, because now you're saying I'm not, you know, my peers out of law school are building a career as lawyers. They're working on the partnership track at the law firms around town. So I was on a totally entrepreneurial path that if it didn't work, and the, you know, players come and go, I'll never forget, I ran into Ted Stepien during this time on a airplane. He's sitting up front in first class. I'm trudging to the back of the plane. He says, "Mark, how's it going?" I said, "Good." He goes, "You know, what players have you signed? And I go, well, I'm working on a couple, nobody knew. He goes, you better get some new clients because those players get old fast. You know, he was very businesslike. I still remember that conversation.
So you gotta get that inventory, baby.
Yes, I mean, it's a business. And I was, and to this day, our relationships with our clients, I never call it family because it's not, you know, we're a team. A lot of the family connotation is thrown around in a disingenuous way, and players fire one day your family, the next day you're fired, and vice versa. But we treated them in a very honest and trustworthy way, fought for them. That comes through in the book. And it's just the reality. If you really wanted to be in the business, as players either get hurt or get or age out, if you want to be in the business, you have to have a clientele, just like a lawyer yeah. or any other entrepreneur. You have to have clients. You have to have car dealers. You have to have repeat customers. So that comment really crystallized some things for me. But before that, I sat down and in 77 in Rockside, one of the restaurants that we used to hang out after games, and Flip Saunders, we're still young guys. He, I think, was coaching in the CBA.
So he's yet to be a head coach.
No. And I was advising him. He was just bopping around all over the country in what was then the CBA. There was no G League. And he said, Mark, you know, you need to start your own agency. And I was a very patient thinker even then. And I was conservative, as you and I have talked. You know, you didn't buy a car until you had the money to pay for it. Yeah. You didn't buy a house until you could put a significant mortgage down, and you were very frugal and disciplined with investments you made in your lifestyle. And that's how I was from my parents and growing up in Garfield Heights. Yeah. So the idea of investing in a business, kind of putting the pressure on myself that not only does I have to do a good job for Ron and Brad and I think Dennis Hobson, and then Jimmy Jackson was coming down the road. The reality was, unlike most businesses, those players could fire their agents like that. And was I fearful of that? Not really, but I was wary of it. I was aware of it. So when you make a commitment to building an agency and some other agent comes along and says, hey, Brad and Ron, I can offer you something to come my way, I trusted those guys implicitly, I had confidence, but there was always that fragility to the business. So it was a big step at that stage because I had to make it work. You know, if that happened, I'd be back to, as I said, writing wills in Garfield Heights, which I didn't want to do.
Pressure was on
to make it work. But Flip helped focus me, encourage me, he believed in me, and the way he said it was like just matter of fact, like basically, what are you doing? You need to just make this commitment, and I did. And I value that advice and that friendship, confidence that he had in me as a friend, but as a business partner, because I was advising him and representing him, to say, it's time to act. Got so it. I had to balance the conservatism, the patience, with the need to act and be aggressive. And I think that's what Mario's saying, and that's why that quote is in the book, to try to encourage people. Don't just be impetuous and make snap decisions. You have to do your homework, but you also have to have confidence, be aggressive, and don't wait around once you feel confident that you have. There's always going to be risk with whatever you do, but balance it and make a decision that can take you where you want to go.
When you had Ron Harper traded away, obviously that was a difficult time for the Cavaliers franchise, losing a talent like Ronnie Harper. How did you handle that? And I saw a quote somewhere where Wayne Embry said, I wish I had talked more with Mark Termini before making that move. What's that all about?
Well, there's a whole story there. That's also a book and a podcast. But for the Ron Harper trade still gets talked about. So anybody that's probably 50 and over and lived it, those younger people, 25 to that age, have read about it. There's still things on the internet. It recurs every so many years because it was so dramatic with the Michael Jordan era, and the Cavs were so good with Ron. They had a very unique group of individuals that I liken to like a jazz quartet.
Yeah, they were synchronized.
Yes, but very disparate and different personalities. They didn't, Mark Price didn't hang out with Ron Harper after practice. But unlike a lot of pro athlete situations, they really got along well. They just were different guys.
Yeah, Brad Larry was Nance, a country boy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Brad, Larry Nance, Mark Price, Ron Harper, Craig Elo, really totally different personalities, but on the court, they're like Miles Davis. And
yeah, they clicked, man.
Yes, they clicked. And so when the Cavs unplugged that,
gotcha.
To this day, people say, we'll never know, but could the Cavs have overcome the Bulls? Michael Jordan to this day says the toughest guy I had to go against was Ron Harper. So there were some extenuating facts that ended up being proven incorrect, but took about 25 years because Ron never had any problems off the court. Never, I look back in the records, I don't think he was ever fined for being late to a practice. He became the ultimate professional, and he ended up getting 5 NBA championship yep. rings after going to LA and tearing his knee up, his ACL, which in those days was a bit of a career.
Yeah, it was like a death sentence.
Yeah, yeah. That was no automatic thing. So we went through some traumatic situations, but it's a tribute to Ron's intelligence, his skill, his ability to reinvent himself, that it worked out that way. But as a young agent, Wayne Embry, we didn't have that relationship.
Gotcha.
And in fact, Wayne will laugh. I just saw him at Ron's Mac Hall of Fame induction ceremony, which is another story about the Mac. I don't know if they've been asleep for like 20 years, but Ron's 59 years old. They just got around to inducting him into the Hall of Fame. So we met there, and Wayne and I are very good friends now, but this many years later. Yeah. The first meeting I had with Wayne, who, for those that don't know, Wayne is and was a huge yeah. individual. His hands yeah. were bigger than that book.
Yeah, he's one of the biggest humans I've been around.
He was a very intimidating yeah. presence to most people.
Wonderful
I mean,
man.
I was very respectful, but I wasn't intimidated because you'll laugh. But in my mind, and only my mind is what formed my outlook, that's what I did playing basketball. I went up against guys that were much bigger, yeah. and they said, who's this guy? And, you know, I felt I could cut him down or get yeah. around him or shoot yeah. over him. So to me, the business thing was kind of the same dynamic. So
gotcha.
I was very respectful always because he's Wayne Embry, and I'm nobody coming in with my first or second client. And I came in to Wayne's office at the Coliseum to the conference room with Ron. And Wayne literally, I think I remember the exact words, with this 6'8", 300-pound presence, shakes your hand, engulfs my whole yeah. hand up to my elbow almost, shakes hands, and we proceed to talk about Ron's situation. And in that discussion, it got a little bit tense in a respectful way because he found out that Ron was from Miami of Ohio. I mean, he knew that. That's one of the reasons they drafted him, where Wayne was from. And I feel the people around the situation thought that Ron was going to fall right in the line and sign what they wanted to offer. First offer, nice and smooth,
yeah.
easy peasy. What else could happen? And then they have me come in. Of course, in those days, I'm, I don't know, 29. I look 19, literally. And Wayne, it got a little heated. He rises up in his seat, and he's talking to Ron. He says, and Termini, I don't know who you think you are. I mean, never those words. Like he was, I'm sure he meant it. He was a little upset because he saw we were going to walk out without a deal. And thankfully, Ron was a very strong and confident individual, even though he had those dynamics. He's coming right from playing from Miami of Ohio. The coaches are very close with Wayne Embry. Very difficult dynamic. But we were on the same page. We strategized. But Wayne, you know, gave me that comment, and that was the undercurrent of the relationship over the next couple of years. It developed in a very respectful one, but in those days, the agents weren't really embraced, let's say, by management.
Yeah.
You know, you bought your ticket, they would rather not see you around. You didn't come to the locker room.
Yeah.
You didn't come to the practices. It was very much an adversarial relationship.
Yeah.
The teams would much rather only deal with the player.
Yeah.
As a little side note, Vince Lombardi's in the book. So in those days, there was very few agents. So a player came in by the name of Jim Ringo, came in to represent, to negotiate
with, Hall of Famer.
With
yeah.
Lombardi. who ran the ship with an iron hand and was pretty much like a Wayne Embry, Gordon Gunn, right? The same era. So Ringo comes in with his representative, his agent, sits down with Lombardi and says, well, Lombardi goes, who's he? He goes, well, that's my representative, my agent, and we're going to negotiate the contract. Lombardi gets up and says, excuse me for a second. Goes in the back room, comes back and says, well, Mr. Ringo, you and your agent have just been traded, you know, to Detroit or someplace. So that was the end. That was the attitude.
Quick phone call, you're gone.
Yeah, so much for coming in with your agent, and you and him are both out of here. And Ringo was a good player. But that reflects the spirit of what we were dealing with in those years. Not like now, where the teams look at the agents as collaborators, facilitators, this, that, and the other thing. Totally, totally different. So the roots of the Ron Harper trade emanate from kind of that, why Wayne said what he did was the atmosphere just wasn't present to create that kind of relationship with an agent. Like it would take, where it would take a year now, would might take 5 years or 10 years to work with somebody to get that trust factor. And in hindsight, he, you know, and look, I admit it, agents as a group are their own worst enemies because they're, you know, and it, back then it was worse. It was like the Tank McNamara caricature of an agent as a hustler, all the gold chains on, hustling, not being honest with their client, lying, willing to say anything. And that was a bad connotation. And they painted everybody with that same brush, where we took great pains. I was a lawyer, you know, just a Cleveland guy and straight and narrow and doing the best I could for my clients, but I was going to fight for them.
Yep.
Now, so being straight, narrow, honest, and not being the guy with the open shirt and the chains on didn't mean I was going to roll over and give whatever you wanted. And that was sometimes hard for teams to reconcile. And that's where the holdouts came from. So that is what Wayne was referencing, because if he would have had more of a line of communication with me, he felt maybe I would have listened to Mark, got more details, not listened to some of the erroneous information that we were given on the street from all the different people that acted like they knew something and turned out to be incorrect. And he, I give him a tremendous amount of credit. And of course, I always respected him. But when he said that in Mary Schmidt Boyer's book, that meant a lot. And it also encapsulated kind of what he said. And he was standing up and saying, look, the trade was bad for the Cavs. It's irrefutable at this point. Right. But that's what he's referring to.
Okay. It makes perfect sense. And it really was a bad trade. And I just felt it was good to kind of point that out, because it went along with your thoughts about having the relationships with the executives that you dealt with, and to have them come at you from an area of respect and you vice versa. Let's move along to 92. You have the fourth pick in the draft, and took a lot of guts on your part to have Jimmy Jackson not play. He missed 54 games, I believe.
Right.
But you got him what you felt he was worth, and this kind of led to a few years later the rookie slotting that we see in basketball. What was the tactic involved there? Why did you go about that particular negotiation that way?
Well, that was still in the same era where the salaries were beginning to skyrocket and getting out of the era where NBA players were highly paid at $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year, but nobody could fathom that that was going to then go within two seasons to $1 million a year to $4 million a year. I still remember Wendy and I were in our kitchen in Bedford Green when the word came, and a lot of your Cavs fans will remember this, where Mark Price got an offer sheet from the Washington Bullets at the time for $1 million a year. And he was a second round draft pick that came in, dropped in the draft, and the area of his contract prior to that offer was like $75,000 a year. That's what second round draft picks got. So when people saw that offer sheet and the Bullets stepped up with that, I had some people that were friends of mine, coaches, were really angry, saying, you agents are going to ruin this business. The golden goose is going to be killed by your greed and driving these salaries. And even then, I was like, I didn't want to be disrespectful. These were mainly middle-aged and older guys. They didn't understand the economics of what was going on, that these salaries wouldn't be offered if the teams couldn't pay them. Right. And Europe was going to come out. There was no China or India in those days, but we could see that coming. Yeah. And but that was the visceral reaction to somebody getting paid $1 million a year. That the year before was a second round, you know, pick. So with the rookies, the attitude was, well, at least Mark Price has proven he's kind of a really good player. But the rookies, you haven't done anything in this league, son. So for an agent to come in and say you want $20 million over whatever it was, 4 or 5 years, that was outrageous. And they were still kind of looking backwards about the salaries being $300,000, $400,000. I was looking forward to where the money I knew was going to go.
Yeah.
So there was intense pressure at that crossroads. So we fall into a situation in Dallas, which let's just say was rooted and enjoyed being in the past, right? They had an owner, very successful man by the name of Donald Carter, that wore cowboy hat and cowboy boots to the games and sat courtside. So he really was not in the mood to see a young agent and a rookie player come to his fiefdom and say, I want something that's like 4 times what you paid your last year's rookie to come play for you as a rookie, not as a proven, any kind of proven commodity. And then there was pressure from the league because all the owners were very cognizant that if the rookie started getting these new contracts, it was going to be, in their minds, Katie bar the door, and all these rookies could come in with a strong representation and really just really turn the salary scale, the salary landscape of the NBA upside down. Because what would happen is if a rookie signs for $3 million a year, you've got your all-star player on the Dallas Mavericks, which I think were, there's several of them. Mark Aguirre was during that era. I don't recall now, but they were probably making $750,000. So here comes this rookie going to make $3 million the first year. You know that player, the veteran all-star, is going to be on the doorstep of the owner
100%.
With his agent saying, hey, now it's my turn. So there was intense pressure to shut down these negotiations with these rookies. So Jimmy was fourth, Shaq was first, Alonzo Mourning was second, and Christian Laettner was third. And the arm wrestling match, the standoff, the holdout was all about, was Jimmy's contract going to be grouped with those guys, 1 through 4, or with the next group of the players below him, which were going to be a cutoff point because they just didn't have the cachet and the leverage to command the kind of deals that 1 through 3 were getting. You know, Shaq was an icon. Christian Laettner was coming off of that historic shot.
Yep.
And Mourning was a very dominating presence. Don't forget, he's a big man. They didn't want to pay the guard. So you had 3 big men,
big man's
two
league
centers then.
Yeah.
Then that were looked at as franchise type of determining players, like a Patrick Ewing, but you're talking about a guard. So all those things factored in and resulted in Jimmy not playing until March of that year, which looking back on it is quite incredible that we did as a tribute to Jim, tribute to Wendy.
Well, first of all, you got him paid out, for as if he played the whole year.
Well, yes, that was the part that just kind of amazed everybody. But there were some machinations behind the scenes and leverage that was imposed on it, because if Jimmy was not signed or traded, and this still applies to some things that happen today in free agency and draft, he would have gone back in the draft. So it took until the trade deadline of the year after the draft. So he's drafted in June of 92. It wasn't until the trade deadline passed in 93 that the Mavericks knew they now, all the bluster and all what was their real position was going to result in them losing the 4th pick in the draft for nothing. So they had spent all this money scouting the previous year. I'm sure $1 million in scouting and salaries to select Jim Jackson. That's the culmination of all their work.
Yeah.
And they knew that Jimmy was extremely valuable player. And they could, if they lost him, that's a setback of major proportions. But we had to drive it and drag it to that point to really see the leverage that we had come to fruition. And it wasn't until Jimmy turned down some trades for minimum salary, and we'll pay you the minimum this year, and then we'll pay you next year. And then when that happened, the Mavericks came with the four-year offer that we wanted, or six-year offer, whatever it was, but it was at the $20 million mark that we wanted. And the rest is history. And people were baffled as how that happened. But that's, you know, that's a short version of the drama, and resulted in me as an agent and our group getting a lot of traction, because I didn't speak during the negotiations at all. But around the country, people were saying, you know, they put the banner up. It's a players' league now. Termini can go to any player and say, come with me, hold out, we'll get what we want. I didn't approach it that way, but that was, you know, it was like you either win or you're dead. Because if that wouldn't have worked out, then it would have been very difficult for me to maintain that kind of career if people said, well, this is the guy that ruined Jimmy Jackson's career, which people were saying was going to happen. But thanks to Jim, who's a very, at the time, amazingly young but strong guy.
Yeah, he
mentally, physically, every which way. And he took heat from, it was like the two of us and a couple people around him were very supportive on an island, literally against the whole country, where a guy like Peter Vesey's in USA Today, which was the
it was widely time, read yeah, all the time.
Right. Yeah, yeah. On a national basis, not local. Yeah. So everybody was saying these guys are making the wrong move, and we had to resist all that pressure. And to Jimmy's credit, you know, very few players would have been able to go through something like that. Nowadays we joke around like the players that you see weeping on draft day, if they're not signed in free agency by July 2nd, yeah, they think the world is over. And we'd laugh, you know, they don't have to sign until October or November or whenever, but it's just a different mentality.
It really seems to be that way, Mark. And you, I know you've said on another podcast, you weren't joking about it. You just had matter-of-fact statements about people that make these artificial, you know, deadlines for
Correct.
Deals to be done. But you were always and have always been not the type of an agent that asks for something. You're kind of telling the team what's going to happen, and you would have enough reserve to wait it out. You didn't get involved in the headlines. You weren't Jerry Maguire, you know, show me the money, all that sort of stuff. And that's been your style. Could you have ever seen scenarios where you felt you would have had to have been more of a public figure in negotiations, or was the being behind the scenes the most comfortable way to get it done?
Right. It was my personality, and I probably allude to it in this book, but in some other lectures I give in that. And look, I would never advise anybody to copy a style. You have to do what your personality lends itself for you to do.
Okay.
You know, so my personality was less verbose, especially when I was younger. I wanted to control everything to the extent I could. I wasn't a Don King personality or a Tank McNamara personality, which was the stereotype of the agent. But I will say there are agents that do that. You have a Drew Rosenhaus is a very upfront guy. It works for him. That's his personality, and it's very successful. So my way of slicing bread isn't the only way to do it, but it's the way that I found successful, and I was confident in it, but I learned as I went. And, you know, I say now that I'm a tell agent, not an ask agent. I never was one that was asking, but it's a matter of assessing your leverage properly, having some confidence and experience in the business, and not perceiving yourself at a inferior position to management, which is how they wanted you to look. And look, these are young players. We've gone through some things even recently in advising young players in other sports where they're just kids. I don't say that as a derogatory, but many agents and advisors are afraid to tell their clients that for fear that they'll lose them or they'll alienate them or they'll get fired. Right? That's the fear. But at a certain point, if I'm even in those days, if I'm a 30-year-old, much less a 50-year-old or a 60-year-old representative, I have to tell the player, this is what you should do. I'm not one of those guys that say, well, I just give him the facts and he decides. Look, they're going to make the decision. But I use the analogy, like anybody that has kids, and everybody parents differently, I get it, but if your young person's at 16 to 18 years old, say, well, this is what I feel like doing, and you're the parent, and you see that it's like I'm gonna go base jumping because I just fun to do, do you say like, well, I'm not gonna tell them what to do? Well, I think I would advise that maybe you tell them, don't do that, unless they're a professional base jumper, yeah. Or using that as an analogy for anything that's risky or not right. An intelligent thing. So I was willing, even at an early stage, to say, look, these are the facts. I've evaluated based on my experience. This is where I think we should go. I'll take responsibility for it. And fortunately, the players that I represented were strong, tough guys. Even at a young stage, they knew they weren't lawyers. They hadn't negotiated contracts like I did. And they had confidence to follow what appeared on the surface to be a unpopular path. But when the results started coming through, then that path became, you know, to the players that signed with me, again, I wasn't a flavor for everybody, but it became one that they said, look, I want to get the best contract. I want to be with Mark Termini. And that resulted, that kind of perception came all the way till this last run of 9 years when I was able to represent some very high level clients and produce for them. And that's, you know, the rest is history in that regard as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, you kind of hopped on that the LeBron train for me, so I don't have to make that segue per se. 9 years with the Clutch Group, LeBron being their top client, obviously, Ben Simmons, Tristan Thompson, Draymond, some big names in NBA annals. But you were, getting back to like the Jimmy Jackson, 92, knowing, reading the tea leaves of where the league was starting to really break out money-wise. You did the same thing in 2014 when LeBron came back, and you did this one and one kind of a contract. Certainly people thought, my God, what is the kid's got all the power. What's going on here? But give me your philosophy as to why you went that route with him sure. and why it worked for LeBron James.
Sure. Well, he was the unique player that could do that. And I did not advise that without a lot of thought and a lot of concern. But like I said before, I don't view it as family, but I take that kind of responsibility for all the guys that put their trust in me, from LeBron to Damon Jones to Earl Boykins, Jimmy Jackson, Tristan Thompson. I always felt that, look, they're looking at me, and if they're willing to put their, literally, their career and their livelihood in my hands, I take that very seriously. And I just don't say it's a family, but it's somebody that's taking this it with the utmost respect sure. and import. So even though LeBron was who he was, I felt there were two reasons for it, to be very clear. It was a money play because I made the evaluation that the salaries were going to skyrocket over the term from 14 and beyond. And without getting too inside baseball and the CBA, if he would have signed a long-term deal with the Cavs right there in 2014, that long-term deal is determined and locked in by whatever the max salary you can get in the first year.
Right.
So if the cap goes up, the guy that signs a max contract the next year is going to get more because that's just the way the accounting rules work, that first year determines the rest of your year. So if you sign that contract in the first year, you're locked in the rest of that term. It doesn't matter where the cap goes. But you get the security and you get the ability to say you're locked in and so forth and so on. But you also get to transfer your control of your career to the team because they have you under contract for 4 years or 5 years or whatever it could be. So the dual determination that I felt was advisable and was worth the measured risk was that by maintaining a short-term deal with a one-and-one, which 2 years were guaranteed, so LeBron still had, I think at the time, close to $80 million guaranteed, but we had the option to come back to the table and do a new deal on a year-by-year basis. So the first thing was the cap's going to go up, and so his salary would go up each year to a higher degree than if he was locked into a long-term deal from day one. And whether you like it or not, as a fan or as management, it kept the player and his representation in more of a control position because the player is going to be a free agent on a year-by-year basis. And I felt LeBron was the only one that could manage that risk because he had made enough money off the court that if something unforeseen happened And there was a subset of decisions behind that. Where Ron Harper suffered an ACL in 1986, it was a career at risk because of the state of medicine. Fortunately, you fast forward to 2014, you don't want to have an ACL or any kind of injury like that, but the reality of the situation at the time was players were coming back from that in a year's time or whatever.
Medicine got more advanced, training.
Exactly.
Rehab.
The procedures. So it wasn't the death sentence career-wise that it was perceived to be almost 20 years earlier. So that goes into the measured risk with my experience, and everybody at Clutch was supportive of that, mainly LeBron. I was the mechanic. You know, they enlisted me because of my experience and all the credit in the world to a young group that at that stage, I don't think there's any other representation in the world that would have that client list, even though Eric Bledsoe, Tristan Thompson, and Corey Joseph were totally unknown commodities and nobody thought they were going to do anything. But, you know, 5 years later, they're combined were over $500 million probably. The only people they worried about was LeBron. But LeBron was confident and respectful enough of my experience and my explanation of the risk factors to say, yeah, I'll go with this. And again, the rest is history. It turned out to be very valuable for him. Like I said, he got an extra $20 million for signing his name three times instead of once. Yeah. So I took pride in that because, as I told one client that fired me because he didn't want to pay the fee, I said, young man, you're the free agent. I'm not the free agent. In other words, I charge a fee. It's a top shelf fee that is the most that you're allowed to charge, but I'm going to come through for you because that's my motivation competitively and business-wise. I want you to pay that fee with a smile and say, you made me way more than what I'm paying you, so therefore I'm comfortable with you know, mm-hmm. what you charge. And that, as you know, I'm very proud of that. And I say it up front, you know, the agent's job is to maximize the salary and the income of the player in an honest way, in a protective way. But that's always been my motto and my explanation to the players, as opposed to a lot of agents cut fees or I'll do this for free or I'll charge one guy one thing, another guy another thing. I never was comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. So when the player came on board with me, they knew what the deal was, and they knew that I was going to fight for them and try to max that out career-wise, control-wise, money-wise, and also trying to protect them and being their advocate, but also, as I say in the book, kind of their sheepdog, because they're young guys and they're basketball players and they're not in my world. They can learn if they're taught and things are explained to them, which I always did. Mm-hmm. Then you're the strongest team that I say that we are, and that's LeBron bought into it and accepted it. Obviously, I couldn't have done it without his confidence in it, as well as everybody else at Clutch. And then that's why we were able to achieve what we did over the 9 years. And then they've taken it to another level and gone off and running out to Beverly Hills. But I'm in Cleveland. I've been here. I'm not leaving, except for my one jaunt to Minneapolis, which is the only place colder than Cleveland I've ever been. I ran right back home. And That's where it stands.
Do you think if Kyrie didn't, you know, pull his trade request or having problems with LeBron, do you think LeBron would still be here?
I don't think LeBron's decisions were going to be determinative of anybody else.
Other than
he doesn't
him.
Think that way, and that's what makes him who he is. You know, and people think like, well, why did he come back to Cleveland? Because they had Kyrie and this guy. That had nothing to do with it. Because his confidence and whatever else you want to call it is like, I'm going home and we're going to win because I am who I am. Whether it's this guy around me or that guy around me, we'll get the guys around me. And I always, I love that, obviously. You know, in hindsight, could they have done more damage in a league if those guys would have stayed together? Probably. But I can't say, look, LeBron is off into a lot of other things off the court, which puts him in a category of one in the world. So I can't predict that. I think he deserves way more credit than he's given for coming back and winning the championship here, which nobody has produced since you would know better than I, 1948 or 64.
64 for the Browns.
Yep. And during that time, you know, Flip had a great impact in that because he traded Kevin Love for Andrew Wiggins. And when I see my young guys at the gym or at the coffee shop, and I ask them, I say, you know, what is the motto of Cleveland sports fans? They look at me, I said, wait till next year. Right? We both grew up with that.
Yeah, we
from
did.
Our 20s.
We sure
and
did.
And I said, well, guess what, son? One day you wake up at the time of 55 and you say, you know, I'm 55. I don't want to just win something right now. Forget the, and I don't say forget. I use, you know, a more strenuous term. Forget. Wait till next year. We're going all in right now.
Yeah.
And that's what drove the LeBron years, trading Wiggins, and all of us that were involved had a lot to do with that. When a lot of teams sometimes talk about, well, we want to have a team for sustained winning.
Right.
I'm like, you know, forget the sustained winning.
Give me a title.
We're Cleveland.
Give me
one time.
Give me a title.
Right. And then we'll pick up the pieces later. We'll see how we do if we can sustain it. But that's really, so my point is he deserves ultimate credit for getting that done. And in my mind, once he did that, whatever he wanted to do, he's carried his burden beyond that which anybody has done in this city. And that's what our goal was. And, you know, he's done an unbelievable job and everybody around him with his career and leaving us with this title, which to this day, for both of us that observed what happened, is one of the most historic days in Cleveland history, much less sports history.
Yeah, it was huge. It was fantastic to cover it. Obviously, the highlight of my career here in Cleveland, without a doubt. And I always had great associations with LeBron. He was always very respectful of the job that we had to do. And I was very respectful of how he went about his business. So I have nothing but tons of respect for him. And I wish the best also to his son, Bronny, going through the situation
sure.
that he is. Let's get back to your book, Words to Negotiate by Mark Termini. You can get it on Amazon. And the reason for the interview, not just to hawk books, we're not here for that per se, but I think there's a lot of great stuff in the book. And
so
I'm going to throw four or five more of these sayings at you, and maybe you give me some thoughts on them. Here is one that I think you even did with, or even Brian Windhorst might have brought it up when he did the podcast with you. Success has 1,000 fathers, but failure is an orphan. That's an anonymous quote. What's your reasoning behind that?
That came from a couple things. Most of my sayings and observations come from my work in the NBA, and it always amused me when I would talk to an NBA scout, especially in the early years, like, who do you like in the draft? And most of them would hedge. I kind of like this guy. I think he can make it. Because they were always very hesitant to, you know, put their name and reputation on a specific player. And what I learned, even internally, that was the dynamic. As scouting staffs became bigger and there was five guys sitting around the table, and some guys were known for being very kind of like in the gray, once in a while guys would step up. But I would, as I also advise in the book, having institutional memory, making note of things that happened. So I would listen to these guys through the years, and I would remember what they say. Well, I'm not sure, and this and that. So when they would make a pick, and that player turned out to be a good pick, then I would ask, you know, they forgot the earlier conversation. They would say, that was the guy I wanted. I told them all. I'm like, wait a second, buddy. I look back at my notes. You were like, I'm not sure. I kind of like this other guy. So in the sports world, and then I found as you get older, it really applies all across the board. You can see it in your business. You'll see it in politics. You'll see it in business. When something succeeds, boy, everybody wants to get in the picture. Everybody wants to say, that was my guy. But when failure occurs, you see the picture is not so populated, and it's just one person standing there, or it's a bunch of people pointing fingers, and now that what they hedged prior is now coming to be their excuse or their explanation about, that was somebody else's, I'm not responsible for that.
Yeah.
And you know, I also correlate it to in the green room when you see the football players, the basketball players. When the guy's the lottery pick, where the agent's right in there, put the arm around,
yeah,
this is my guy. When the player drops and it's
the
that last guy.
The kid's just sitting there, look, that camera's right in his
right,
face.
And the agent finds a way to say, hey, I'm going to have my associate in that picture. Or I'm going to get out of the picture. You know, figuratively or literally,
yep,
that's where that came from.
That's a good one. leave nothing to chance. And this is from an HBO show called Luck.
That comes from my philosophy that you really have to do your preparation and your homework. And a lot of times I found, and I make the comment in that to that axiom, well, it is what it is, or what will be, which a lot of people invoke as kind of an excuse or an explanation when something happens that doesn't turn out the way that it should, as if they had no control over it. And there are things in life and business, look, you have no control no matter, right. Or it goes a different way, irregardless of the preparation you make or you invest or your skill. But I find a lot of times that it happens a lot because people don't prepare, or they don't have the skill, or they don't have the experience to try to look around the corner down the road. And what pressured me and developed my skills was that pressure that I was under from the players and from my clients to produce for them. And you either have to handle that pressure and turn it into a fundamental to prepare. That was my mantra. Whether it was as a player, I shot the most free throws. You know, July 4th wasn't a holiday. It was a day to practice more and get ahead of the guys that were at the beach or taking a holiday. So it was part of preparation. That's where this comes from. Like, the more that I can prepare for, foresee, control, the better chances I have for the outcome that I want to achieve, a successful outcome.
Yep.
And I encourage people, don't just use that as an excuse about, well, I can't control that, or that's out of my control, or if something comes out that I haven't planned for, you know, you're leaving it to chance. To the extent that you can control things further out down the road to make your result happen the way you want, invest that time and effort and learning, and maybe it's reading, or maybe it's investing time with your client to reduce your risk that chance is going to jeopardize a positive result. That's really where it emanates from.
Very good. Leave nothing to chance. I like that. All right. I don't equate money with success. Creative people would rather get credit. We're obsessed with credit, but don't mind if we're often paid a pittance. Monty Python, John Cleese, right. Great actor, comedian. Sure. Why that one?
I think athletes are creative people. And when I started, we didn't call them entertainers. They didn't really refer to themselves as entertainers the way they do now, where they can, you know, feel that they're entertainers, artists, so it really doesn't matter, but they are. They're creative people. They're creating on the court. It's a ballet. It's entertainment. And I don't agree with the excuse or the perception that some athletes have when they come in. We've seen it recently with actors, even though Mr. Cleese, a very accomplished personality,
mm-hmm.
that my job as a representative is to translate that into the respect that is equated with what they're paid. Making the point that the artist sometimes is their own worst enemy. And he's hitting on something that is, I've seen many, many times, that like, look, I want credit. If you give me credit, in other words, my, you know, so-and-so had a great season. He's responsible for this. He's responsible for that. That's great. You should have that. But you should also have what goes along with it is the monetary compensation. Because in pro sports, I don't know about the movie business, even though I think it equates more than Mr. Cleese is alluding to. In sports, you are respected based on what your contract is to a great extent. If you have a good player, but you have a really, really poor contract, people kind of snicker, or the athletes, your fellow players in the locker room, think that you've let opportunities slip by. So that was always my goal. Don't let that, because the team wants to say, hey, we'll do this. We'll feature in commercials. We'll give you this credit, but we're going to short you or not give you the maximum amount that maybe we would on the contract. It was my job not to allow that. I'll get you your credit. That's fine as an artist. You want your credit, but you also need to have your business taken care of.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense to me. Celebrities are never keen on obeying orders. This is a weird one in my sense, because they're really, some are very difficult to handle or to be around, and some celebrities are, they just go with the wind. Like, whatever will be. Mm-hmm. Why do you have this in the book?
Probably, it cuts both ways depending on the individual. You know, there's blanket statements that have the exceptions, but in the particular author of that quote was relating to his experience, and I seized on it because in my world, and when you think about it now, you're dealing with young athletes and players that some of them from the age of 13, 14 years of age enter what I call a bubble person world where they go through life and nobody ever tells them they can't do something or that they're not the greatest, or if they want to cut the line figuratively or literally, they're able to do it. And then when you add the monetary component to it and they become maybe a worldwide celebrity or a regional celebrity or an NBA celebrity, it's so rare that they're actually told you have to do something different in your life. It could be don't buy this car or don't waste money on this or don't sign within 3 days of free agency. Anything that you can think of. And either, you know, we've seen in this era, you talk about player empowerment and yeah. how teams deal with players. Sometimes I look at the teams and say, wow, I wish I had 30 more years to deal in this era where the teams, if a player says, oh, I want to be traded, they immediately scamper to the phones and start working on it, as opposed to just saying, well, no, thank you for that, but you're under contract and I'm not just going to consent to your wishes. You see a few of it at times.
Or take a bad deal just to get you out of here.
For sure.
Yeah.
So as I say in the comment to that quote, as a representative, you have to have the confidence, the stature, the respect to be able to tell somebody who in the real world could be a massive celebrity and has ordered his life based on how that affects him in his bubble, maybe for 10 or 15 years, and tell him, you know, no, we're not going to do that. If you do that, then you can get a new advisor. Or this is in your best interest to do it this way. I've seen many times celebrities in my world are reticent to take that kind of advice. And that comes with the package with me. If I really believe in it and I say this is what you should do, it doesn't matter who you are. I have a track record of results. I think you should do this. And in this particular decision, in my experience, I've been able, fortunately, to develop that kind of respect factor. I haven't had that very often where somebody disagrees with me based on their view of the world because they're so widely known. But I've seen it happen. And I've seen a lot of agents, very experienced and respected ones, but their mode is more, hey, I'll advise him what to do and let him make a decision. It ties in with that. And that's just not the way I operate. And I think you do the celebrity a disservice mm-hmm. if you see the world in an accurate way and you can provide the results, but you're reticent to push that because a celebrity is wired to like nobody tells me what to do. We see it every day in the media. You know, a guy wants to park in the handicap spot or this. It's all part of that whole psychology. Yeah. They're not used to being told what to do or having to follow the rules that everybody else has to. And it also bleeds over into negotiations in their business. And I've seen, you know, and had to deal with those same kind of attitudes, at least initially.
Gotcha.
Until we get a better relationship and they understand that what I say makes sense for them. And I don't really care about if the crowds gather or fall down at their feet when they walk out of our meeting.
Gotcha.
You have to be able to deal with that.
Here's the last one of the ones I picked out, and I think it may be one of your favorites. Sands of time. What in essence are you referring to? And this is something you wrote. Like, if you pick up this book that Mark has put out there, you're going to see a lot of sayings from a myriad of people. You know, they could be cartoon characters, they could be actors, they could be obviously great philosophers, warriors, athletes, and what have you, but you always have a little snippet alongside these quotes with your feelings, how they pertain to you as a negotiator, as an agent, and that sort of thing. But in this one, this is just something about the sands of time. And it seems like to me, if I'm reading the tea leaves, it's something that's one of your favorites.
Well, preliminary to me getting the sands of time, it's funny you focus on the, I call it an eclectic group of people
that you
quotations.
Quote.
So I have a very experienced and accomplished editor that when we were putting this together, he looked at the draft. He said, Mark, you know, you have your own quotes in here along with those from Abraham Lincoln and Margaret Thatcher.
Or Marcus Aurelius or whatever.
And I didn't think anything of it. I'm like, well, I like theirs and I have my own. I just, because I've never seen a book like this. Are you sure? You know, that is odd to me and people might look at you the wrong way. And I thought about it for a minute. And I said, well, hey, did Abraham Lincoln or Margaret Thatcher ever negotiate $2 billion in NBA contracts? And that was the end of that discussion, you know, because he kind of was hinting like, I think we should take your quotes out and leave Abraham, Margaret, and Publius in there. And I said, no, mine are staying in. So this is one of them.
Okay.
So the sands of time is something that we don't think about when we're young, because of course we feel that we have an infinite amount of time. And so what I've tried to do, and I learned as we all grow older, and I was, when you asked me, like, where does that come from? It's as simple as it comes from getting older, John. You know, that's just the way it is.
I think I know that.
But we're both at the top of our game, so, you know, it doesn't apply as much to us. But I picture that hourglass over, you know, my bed on the wall when you wake up in the morning. And there's a finite number of grains of sand that's your time that we have to spend here and operate and work and live. And I found it is a good reminder and a check and balance. And I share it with the young people now. And I wish somebody would have told me that when I was younger, that my advice is don't be frivolous with what you do with your time. Yeah. That's, time is like the only commodity. It is a commodity. You can't buy it. Yeah. You can't create more of it. No matter how talented or how wealthy you are,
it's fine. You talk,
you know, it is only what you're granted in this life to have. So as you go through your days, you know, as I say in the book, I want to be with and around people that I value. I want to devote time to things that are worthwhile. I want to use those sands wisely because they're dropping through the hourglass, whether you're 20 years old or whether you're 70 years old. And most people have been pretty receptive to that and given me some good feedback, even the younger people. It's as simple as like, look, you know, do things that make sense as opposed to squandering things frivolously that we all of us look back and go, wow, that was a wasted relationship, or that was a wasted trip, or that was a wasted summer. It doesn't mean you can't have fun, relax, do things. All of us are going to learn from the paths that we take. But if you're more conscious of it, you'll tend to be more efficient and more productive and get more out of the time that you do have.
Mark, of all the time that I've spent with you over the years, we've known each other for, you know, many, many years. In fact, I've even looked back to, you were at Case Western Reserve from 74 to 78.
Yes.
Okay. And I only wish that I had gotten my first TV job right out of college in 1975 in Cleveland, Ohio. I would have had a chance to cover you, the college athlete. But getting back to your last quote, of all the interactions I've had with you, we've squandered not a second. They've all been productive in my estimation.
They've been great. JT.
And this was a real treat to sit down and talk to you about your career, your philosophies, and this book, Words to Negotiate by Mark Termini. I think a lot of folks will enjoy it when they pick it up. And it's something that you can just have nearby. You don't have to sit there and read it cover to cover in the first time you have it in your hands. But I think it's something that you just pick up and see a quote here and there and see how it applies to your life. It's really an enjoyable book to read, but just it's been a great knowing you all these years, and I wish you
nothing but the success. Thanks for all that. I hope that a few sands that you've invested you feel good about, and appreciate you showing the interest in talking about the book.
All the best.
Mark and his partner in life and his partner in the business, Wendy, they were on hand on August the 6th at a ceremony that rededicated the Flip Saunders Recreation Courts in Brooklyn Heights. And Flip's widow, Debbie, her son, Ryan, who is a Nuggets assistant coach, so he's a world champion NBA assistant coach. They were on hand for the ceremony as well. Flip Saunders passed away in 2015 of Hodgkin's lymphoma. Mark is in the Holy Name High School and the Case Western Reserve Halls of Fame. He was a great basketball player. The men's basketball locker room at Case Western Reserve is dedicated in Mark Termini's honor. And if you want to know more about Mark, go to marktermini.com. That is marktermini.com to get more information on the deals he negotiated, his clients, and what have you. Not every client was in the NBA world. A few were selected outside of the basketball world, if you will. One hits close to home. My former colleague at Channel 8, Mr. Vince Cellini, was in our department, had so much talent. I always thought he was way better than Cleveland, Ohio, if you want to be very specific about it. And Vince was frustrated at his place in our sports department. He got together with Mark Termini, and Vince pushed the envelope. And between Mark and Vinny, they were able to get him a great job at the CNN shop down there in Atlanta, and he flourished as a host of various types of sports shows, the Golf Channel, you name it. All of that was because he had the guts to move down to Atlanta and take a chance on his career, and Mark Termini was the man who helped facilitate that. Congratulations to my buddy Vince Cellini. Hope you enjoyed the interview. Please rate, subscribe, review, drop comments. And all that stuff helps the algorithms with all the apps that push out these podcasts. Certainly hope you get a chance to even aggregate some of what Mark had to say in our interview. I welcome that as well. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you the next time on Telich Talks. Until then, please drive responsibly.